I think Steve's made a really, really great point. The one that really resonates with me when preparing for scholarship is don't generalize, overgeneralize about Māori. You know, think, and what I want to do is I want to say today, let's not generalize about Pākehā either. And so that's what I want to talk about. Because I think, you know, I think a really good scholarship answer is one that acknowledges exactly as Steve said, regional variation, difference in background, different of opinion. Because as we know about all our groups and societies, our schools, every community that we're part of, there's a range of people in each one with a range of backgrounds and with a range of different views. And so I think that I want to continue that theme. And I want to do that today by, first of all, looking at Pākehā migration to New Zealand in the 19th century. And in particular, I want to look at, I'm going to show you a graph of migration in the 19th century, do a bit of a recap of the major waves. So I guess in a sense, do a bit of generalizing. Then I want to refresh your mind about what historians have said about migration and Pākehā society in the 19th century, what generalizations have been made. And then the main part of the exhibition of this talk is I want to drill down into the data, and I want to use one of my favourite parts of nzhistory.net, which is an exhibition which was up in one really early days of nzhistory.net called Home Away From Home. And it looks at the data around migration to New Zealand in the 19th century from British and Irish migrants. Looked at their death certificates and ship records and all these sorts of things, built up a massive database to say who actually were our 19th century British and Irish ancestors, and what conclusions can we draw about New Zealand society from looking at where they came from, what were the reasons they came to New Zealand, and so on. And then if we've got time at the end, I just want to leave you with three case studies of Pākehā people who migrated to New Zealand that you might be able to use in your answers. Some who loved New Zealand, some who hated it. And there's a part of the Level 3 course which asks you to evaluate the fears and aspirations and hopes of 19th century New Zealanders. And I, you know, don't think you can generalise about the fears and aspirations and hopes of 19th century New Zealanders. I think that we've got, you know, they, like us, they had different fears and different hopes and different aspirations. But what we can say is, here's some people that we know about and this is how they felt. Okay, so it's going to be a bit of a whirlwind, but let's get into it. So on nzhistory.net, there's this terrific migration graph. And there's also one at Te Papa, which I really love, in passports, which shows sort of the different waves of migration. So there's three parts to this. The key, as you know, is always the key, if you like, to actually unpacking graphs and NCA and scholarship history exams. But basically, the blue line's the immigration total. The magenta line is the net migration, and the yellow is the assisted migration. So you can see that assisted migration is a really important part of the migration experience. So what's the difference between immigration total and net migration? What's the difference on the map, but what, you know, as a geographer, what would be the difference between those two things? How do you calculate the immigration total and how do you calculate the net migration? Yeah, so what geographers call net migration outflow, so or immigration. So let's have a look. We've got this early period, the New Zealand Company. Isn't it remarkable how few people come to New Zealand as part of the New Zealand Company settlements, and yet we devote so much space to looking at them? But maybe they are important because they set up, you know, some of the patterns and the nature of society. They do the naming and claiming of the various towns. And then we've got this massive gold boom, massive, massive gold boom in the 1860s, with I think more than 100,000 people coming to New Zealand. And that's almost matched in the 1870s through the Vogel period. And you can see all these assisted migrants coming in. And then in 1888, we see a period where there's net migration outflow. More people leaving New Zealand than arriving. Why is that?
Is that many leaving to Sydney after the Long Depression?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, Australia's, I think also a lot of Australian settlements are also recovering from got a depression on at that time as well. But nonetheless, people are on the move. But New Zealand's population continues growing during this time. Why is that? There's net migration outflow. Why is New Zealand's population growing? What's the other determinant of New Zealand's population other than immigration? Death, that's right, so births and deaths. I think Belloc used the phrase, the womb overtook the ship in the later part of the century as the key determinant of New Zealand's population. So one of the things you might have looked at this year is Fairbairn's view. Now, this isn't new stuff. You know, I'm not, you know, this is, I think the article, I think, of Fairbairn's atomization thesis probably came out in about 1986, and the book came out about 1988 or 1989, before I sat bursary history and got that wonderful 54%. In this book, a really important book, if you're looking at New Zealand social history, a book that sparked perhaps more debate than any other you know, theory in recent New Zealand historiography, Fairbairn outlined the way in which the propaganda about New Zealand in the 19th century described New Zealand as an ideal society. And Fairbairn goes on to say, you know, in some ways, New Zealand was an ideal society. You know, in many ways, settlers' dreams about New Zealand were realised. But the consequences of what the New Zealand society that settlers developed weren't exactly those that people had expected. And so he paints a picture of New Zealand having weak community, and he paints a picture of frontier chaos. So New Zealand society, he argued in the 19th century, was not defined by community, as many had argued before, but it was defined by individualism. There was a selfishness, if you like, about migrants. People were coming to New Zealand to better themselves, and therefore they weren't prepared to stay and be part of communities. They wanted to keep moving, and communities were therefore weak. And part of this, as he points out, is the rapid immigration of migrants to the hinterland. So they arrive in settlements, and then they're spreading out quickly out into the hinterland in New Zealand. And coming with this lack of social cohesion comes drunkenness, comes violence, and comes extreme loneliness for New Zealanders. So he paints a picture of New Zealand sort of being made up of lonely atoms, walking around New Zealand, bumping into each other occasionally, having a fight, and very little community. And he says this explains a lot about the way that New Zealand history panned out. Well, it's fair to say that few historians agree. So both before and after the Fairbairn thesis, historians like Rollo Arnold and Bill Oliver wrote community histories of New Zealand. And this book that Rollo Arnold wrote called New Zealand's Burning showed how in Taranaki, settlers worked incredibly closely together when they were burning off their farms from scrub and various things like that. There was community that was taking place in New Zealand both before and after. So they've sort of, you know, challenged that view, they've challenged the view of Fairbairn. And of course, in this building, Jock Phillips, also in the 1980s, wrote a book called A Man's Country. And his thing has probably moved on probably since this as well. But in this book, he creates an image of New Zealand being very dominated by men in the 19th century. He used the phrase truth by numbers. He says men outnumbered women for the 19th century, and therefore a distinct male society develops. He perhaps could have looked more at some of the regional variations that existed. For example, in Dunedin in the 19th century, I think there's more, certainly in the settled area, like around Caversham, there's more women than men. And in the suburbs of Auckland, there were more women than men as well. But nonetheless, over New Zealand, there were more Pākehā men than women for the whole 19th century. And he argued that a distinct male society developed as a result. And Caroline Daly, in her book, Girls and Women, Men and Boys, wrote about Taradale. And she showed how family and gender were important community bonding things within Taradale in Hawke's Bay. And then in Paradise Reforged, the second part of Belich's general history of New Zealand, he starts to develop a theory around called recolonisation. And what Belich says is that New Zealand society, especially after the invention or the use of refrigerated shipping in New Zealand, that New Zealand society becomes very dominated by England. And so New Zealand, as a result of effectively becoming Britain's farm, starts to import ideas and as well as products from the United Kingdom. And so New Zealand's education system starts to reflect an English public school education system. And various other features of British society are transplanted into New Zealand. There's a recolonisation that takes place. And of course, since then, he's now expanded that theory and looked at it in a transnational sense.